This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and welcome to a special Thanksgiving edition of the show. And whether you're observing the holiday today or not, we're glad to be with you. Today is a national holiday created by President Lincoln via decree, intended for Americans to pause, reflect, and give thanks. Over the years, we have come to recognize the holiday in part as celebrating an American mythology, one that tells a skewed story of the founding of Plymouth Colony and the arrival of European settlers to this land, and the people who were and still are here, indigenous tribes of New England. Today, in 2021, we as a Commonwealth and nation have been rethinking the stories we tell ourselves about our history, around race, colonization, and our founding. This hour on the show, we are revisiting some of our favorite recent segments about rethinking complex histories through the celebration and commemoration of holidays. We'll hear a little later about the New Hampshire woman who became the godmother of our national Thanksgiving in the 1800s. Then we'll hear about the history of America's newest national holiday, Juneteenth. But first, more than 400 years since the Mayflower landed in Patuxent, now known as Plymouth, we want to explore what a complete truth-telling of the Mayflower story would mean. We're going to hear from Linda Coombs, who is a part of the Aquinawampanoag tribe. She's a tribal historian and independent scholar. She worked for 30 years at the Plymouth Patuxent Museum. She spoke with us back in December 2020, marking the commemoration of the Mayflower's arrival there.
Other anniversaries of the landing of the Mayflower have been put on as celebrations, and what gets left out of that story is the Wampanoag people, because the Mayflower sailed into Patuxent. That's the village space that they landed in. But they sailed into the territory of the larger nation of Wampanoag people, which had 69 villages at one time, of which Patuxent was one. Okay. And even though we had suffered a huge plague and had lost, you know, a greater percentage of our population, there were probably, we estimate, 20,000 people or so still left in the Wampanoag nation.
And the losses from that plague, Linda, tell us a little bit more about that, because it was a massive loss.
Yes, it was massive, and it often gets construed that we all died out, which was not the case. Entire villages were lost, and, you know, if there were any survivors, they moved to other villages, but there's no record that exists of that. But there still were many intact villages, like south of Plymouth, I think on the western edge of Wampanoag country, which is on the eastern side of Narragansett Bay, that remained intact. And even though we had lost a lot when the Mayflower landed, I think that people were kind of in the process of trying to reformulate and regroup, you know, from, because the plague was 16 to 18. So.
In reading an interview with you, Linda, in preparing for this, one of the things that you pointed out that was just so striking to me was there was this massive loss of life that the pilgrims, you felt, construed as God clearing the path for them.
There were different people, John Smith, Nathaniel Morton, I think, you know, various people authors who wrote things, and they did say that this cleared the land for a better people.
That's got to be painful.
Yes, absolutely. It is. Because that type of thinking, you know, kind of, you know, in a way set the stage for Wampanoag and, you know, subsequently other indigenous people becoming invisible and being discounted, and, you know, and all that sort of thing.
So, Linda, tell us about some of the first interactions between Native people and the pilgrims who were on the Mayflower when they began to settle in, again, what was then Patuxent.
Well, the village of Patuxent was one that was, as far as we know, entirely wiped out, with the exception of Squanto. And he survived because, by virtue of having been kidnapped back in 1614 and taken to England and sold into slavery, And 5 years later, in 1619, he managed to, you know, get passage back here, and he found his entire village just gone. He was looking literally at bones strewn all over the ground, because when this, you know, illness hit a particular village or area, people got sick so fast and died so fast that there was no one to care for the sick, no one to bury them. So it was all right there, you know, when the Mayflower pulled up. And then it was 6 months before any Native people contacted the English. And the first person was a man named Samoset, who was actually Abenaki. He was a chief, I believe, that used to just come down to this area and visit. And I'm not sure how he was the one who got to go into the English village the following March and see what they were about. But that is what happened. And he and then with Squanto ended up arranging a meeting with Usamequin and, you know, and the English leadership, which resulted in an alliance of mutual protection.
With Massasoit, yes, the chief of the Wampanoags. And was what were the characteristics?
No, wait a minute. Massasoit was not the chief of the Wampanoags. He was the chief of the Pokanokets.
Thank you.
One village.
I'm learning so much.
Wampanoag Nation, okay?
Okay.
And he often gets construed as being the chief of the Wampanoags, but he was a very well-respected, very influential, and very loved leader, and which I think is what, you know, people said, you know, Massasoit's the guy that needs to go to Plymouth, because there was the villages in between. Pokanoket is where, you know, on the western edge of Wampanoag territory, where Warren and Bristol, Rhode Island, are today. And he got the job because of the nature of his character and the experience that he had to come out and see what the English were about and to establish the relationship that he did with them.
Linda, we talked at the beginning of the show. I think you heard our conversation with Richard. And one of the things we talked about was the Mayflower Pact, which gets taught in history classes as a set of rules that governed life on then Plymouth Plantation. It's often spoken of as, you know, a pioneering document in self-governance. And yet self-governance was already, the Native peoples here on the continent already had very sophisticated systems of self and tribal governance. So is it fair to credit the Mayflower Compact as being as pioneering as it often is in history classes as self-governance?
I don't think so, because it may have been pioneering for the English people, but that's only part of the story. The other part is the fact that the Native nations here had very formal types of governance. It varied from nation to nation, you know, but we did have very, you know, structured and formal type of government that worked. It worked for thousands of years, thousands and thousands. And that has all been not told and been discounted. We've been, you know, portrayed as like just randomly being here, happenstance way of life. Lucky if we caught a deer when it was running by, and, you know, all of this sort of thing that just discredits, you know, and builds a lack of ignorance as to what our true culture and governance was actually like.
So I want to look at our understanding of the Wampanoag people today, too. We had a chance to speak with Darius C. Coombs, director of the Wampanoag and Algonquin Interpretive Training. He's a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. I think he's your brother-in-law, yes?
Yes.
Okay. And he talked to us a little bit about why all of the pilgrims are reenactors, but not those who represent the tribe. Here he is.
If we're down there dressed up in skins and our traditional clothing, no matter what, if we have that on or we have a pair of jeans on, we are still the people, you know. We don't shut off at 5, turn on at 9. And that's the biggest difference right there. And a lot of people don't realize that. They come on down to the Wampanoag home and say, wow, a lot of things they first say is, I don't think you guys are still around anymore. And we're still here.
You know, I was struck, Linda, at the beginning of our conversation when you talked about how many people think that members of the Wampanoag tribe are gone, which I imagine, again, is quite painful. How important is it to bring the current tribe members an awareness that this is 400 years later, a living community of people, not a piece of history?
It's extremely important, just by virtue of the fact that we are a group of human beings that are still here. And the history that happened with our tribe, with the Mayflower coming in and the English settling in our territory, that's pivotal and foundational to American history. And everything that's associated with it, if it happened, it deserves to be told. History deserves to be told as it happened, you know, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, in its rightful context. Okay, and, you know, there's so much in the telling of history where that just doesn't happen, and you end up with the mythology or the complete misinformation, the complete lack of understanding that comes, or just, as Darius just said, you know, people don't even think we're still here. And yet,
Linda, I want to grab one call. We've got a caller, Marcus from Cambridge. Marcus, go ahead.
Yes, you just described the Wampanoags watching the Mayflower come in. Last year I went to the Wampanoag, the powwow in Mashpee Wampanoag, also the Nipmuc, the Narragansett, and the Pequot powwows in anticipation of this year. And I was anticipating, as were many of us, of watching the Mayflower sail rather than putter into Plymouth Harbor. And I'm hoping that next year, perhaps at Thanksgiving, there will be we will be able to witness that with the Wampanoag reenactors watching the Mayflower come in, and the New England reenactors creating New England.
Marcus, I'm going to take it back from you there. I think we get the idea of what your call is, and there's a piece I want to bring back to Linda. So Marcus is talking about what he'd like to see, but he referred to the Wampanoag as reenactors. I think Darius was telling us that's an important distinction, not reenactors, people who are here
exactly
now.
We
so
are
talk
Wampanoag
just a little
people
more about that.
Yes. Well, I mentioned earlier that we originally had 69 villages in our nation, many of whom were, you know, lost in the plague. And over the following four centuries, between 1620 and now, there's a ton of history and the process of colonization that happened, where the English were imposing certain types of things on us to change us. I'm kind of struggling with how to make a very long story, you know, into a sentence here. But and as a result, you know, the communities that we had, some were on the traditional place where they always had been, some were not, and they had different functions because of the changes that the English brought. But you know, so over the years, you know, many of these people or these villages just kind of went away. Either people moved out or they simply died out, or there was intermarriage and the tribal group just went away, you know, in all any of those ways. So today we have three remaining historic Wampanoag tribes. The Mashpee Wampanoag on Cape Cod is the largest. Aquinna Wampanoag on Martha's Vineyard, and then the Herring Pond Wampanoag people in South Plymouth and Bourne. So, and we number 5,000 to 6,000 people in total, you know, which always strikes me because I know that in the United States, there's like 10 million Mayflower descendants, you know, so.
Linda Coombs, who is a part of the Aquinna Wampanoag tribe, is a tribal historian and independent scholar. She spoke with us back in December 2020. In October of this year, the first time that Boston celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day, we spoke with Paula Peters. She is a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and an independent scholar of Wampanoag history. Indigenous Peoples Day falls on the national holiday recognized as Columbus Day, and this year also Marathon Monday. And Peters echoed what we'd heard from Linda Coombs. A truer telling of the history of Columbus is needed, and that Native peoples are still here, still important parts of our community.
Our story overall is unfamiliar to America. And that's one of the reasons why Indigenous Peoples Day is it's an important reflection on the first people of this nation. And it is time to remember who we are. It's time to honor our ancestors, whether they're ancestors from the last century or 500 years ago. We've been here and are still here.
Paula, so now we are in this moment. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey last week declares today Indigenous Peoples Day in the city of Boston. President Joe Biden has proclamations saying, recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts still recognizes today as Columbus Day. So we are in this in-between space. What is your reaction to all of that? How do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard for me to understand how out of one side of our mouth, we can recognize that it's time to honor Native people, and then out of the other side, you can't wrap your head around what a tyrannical and barbaric person Christopher Columbus was, and I know that there are some Italian Americans who feel like the day is being taken away from them, and it's not. We're having a new reflection on this day based on what we really know to be true about Christopher Columbus and what he did to Indigenous people.
So let's stay with that piece of complexity for a moment, because for at least some Italian Americans, they understand the history of Columbus, but Columbus Day has been a way to recognize the contributions and experiences of Italian Americans and the immigrant experience of Italian Americans in the country. How to think about that?
Yeah, but it's still Columbus Day to them. I mean, why not Marconi Day? I mean, Marconi, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be communicating on this great space that is the radio that he is responsible for bringing to this world. Why not Leonardo da Vinci Day, or why not Gina Lota Brigida Day? There's so many people to celebrate of Italian heritage that if I had a choice to celebrate someone, it wouldn't be Christopher Columbus. He committed within 5 years a genocide that was unimaginable. He was enslaving people. He was overseeing his men who raped women and killed children. This is not someone that you want to have to celebrate.
All right, so let's talk about the celebration now of Indigenous Peoples Day. For some communities, Boston and Newton, for example, this is their first official observance of Indigenous Peoples Day this year. Is there something in particular that a community should do or that you'd like to see a community to do in their first observance?
I think that they should acknowledge the Indigenous people of the place that they live, and acknowledge those of us that are still here. I think we have a long way to go to getting this right. But it's been a long time coming just to get Indigenous Peoples Day recognized.
Paula Peters is a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and an independent scholar of Wampanoag history. She spoke with us on Indigenous Peoples Day this year. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a special Thanksgiving edition of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special hour of Radio Boston, a Thanksgiving edition. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are listening back to recent conversations we've had on the show about rethinking local and national history, especially history we observe through holidays. Our next segment is about New Hampshire's own Sarah Josepha Hale. She was a complex, remarkable woman from the 19th century, championing women's rights to work and education long before the Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls in 1848. She also served as America's first successful female literary editor and the godmother of our national Thanksgiving holiday, pushing President Abraham Lincoln to declare it so. Connecticut author Melanie Kirkpatrick wrote a new biography of Hale, Lady Editor, Sarah Josepha Hale and the Making of the Modern American Woman. And she spoke with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna in August about who Hale was in her time.
She was probably the best known woman of the 19th century. And she was because of the two magazines that she edited. The Ladies magazine that she became the founding editor of in 1828 in Boston, which was then purchased by Lewis Godey of Philadelphia in order so that he could get Sarah Hale as editor of his magazine, which became known as Godey's Ladies Book. She was a dynamic woman, a very intelligent and determined woman. And when her husband died in 1822, leaving her with four children and a fifth on the way, she was determined to give them a good education. The only respectable occupation open to a woman of the day was needlework, which she hated. So she transformed herself into one of the first women to earn her living by a pen. And catching the attention of the man who was starting the Ladies magazine in Boston, she moved there and decided to use the magazine to pursue two important themes. One was education for women. And the second issue was developing an American culture. She thought that while America had won the Revolutionary War and was independent from Britain, it hadn't developed its own common culture, literary culture or popular culture. And she set out to change that.
You know, she was born the year before Washington took office and lived for 90 years. So she sort of spanned this remarkable time in American history, post-revolution and antebellum America, the Civil War and Reconstruction. What was it like for her to be at the forefront of opinion making at that time?
Well, first, being a woman and creating a serious intellectual magazine was unheard of. So she was taking a big risk. She decided, she was a widow, of course, and it's interesting that to me that she chose to stay in mourning for the rest of her life, 57 years, dressed in black. I think in part it was to honor her late husband, but I also think there was a practical reason. Her black attire signaled to the people she dealt with that she was a widow, and therefore she had the right to manage her own affairs. Back in that period, American women who married were required to hand over all of their financial affairs to their husbands. But Mrs. Hale, as a widow, was able to act for herself. And that gave her a certain status that I think helped her in creating, turning her magazines into the success, the successes that they
sort
were.
Sort of found the loophole of the day. But you know, there's so many different directions we could go here. And I do want to get to Thanksgiving. I also want to get to this idea that, like any figure from history, she's complex. She's, as you described, a strong advocate for women's rights. But yet, she didn't go as far as voting rights. And so I'm wondering if you could explain that sort of seeming conflict when viewed from 2021, where we have a woman Speaker of the House, a woman Vice President.
Well, you're right. She did not support women's right to vote. She thought politics was a dirty business, and who could blame her? She lived in the Jacksonian age, and she thought women were of a higher moral character and should exercise their influence from the high ground, so to speak. But, you know, people change and people evolve. And in 1828, the idea of a woman being a teacher was a radical idea. And yet she hammered home that idea. Then she hammered home the idea that women could
And went further than hammered home, right? Helped found Vassar College,
you know,
started multiple schools. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. No women could go to college when she started her career in 1828. And only half of American women were literate. And also, I should point out, this was 20 years before Seneca Falls. So I would say she was a radical.
Sort of landmark women's rights convention.
Precisely. And at the end of her life, she lived to be 90. In the last few years, she did come to champion elections for women to school boards, which I thought was very interesting. And, you know, if she'd lived another 50 years, maybe she would have changed her mind. And I think that Hale understood how important school boards were in our grassroots democracy.
So another issue central to her times, of course, was slavery and abolition and eventually the Civil War. And you write that while she was personally and morally opposed to the institution of slavery, she also didn't use the pages of her magazines to try to shape the thinking of the coming war and then you know, following. Again, can you help us understand that sort of maybe today from 2021 seemingly conflicting beliefs?
She was a woman of the 18th century, highly patriotic. Washington was her hero. She was the daughter of a man who had fought in the Revolution. And she thought that the bargain that the founders made about slavery was preserve the Union. And for her, the highest good was preserving the Union. She thought that slavery was wrong, as you noted, but she thought that eventually it would end, but she didn't want to go to war over it. She also was a supporter of what was called the American Colonization Society. And this was a society that helped to found the country of Liberia in Africa. Of course, it was founded by freed American slaves. And she believed that a good solution for slavery would be to facilitate sending American freed slaves to Africa. She didn't think they could succeed in the United States, that there was so much prejudice and so much discrimination that it would be very hard for freed slaves to succeed.
Sort of predicting Jim Crow, I suppose. But again, that is a little bit of a tough pill to swallow in 2021. So how do you think about her legacy on that front today?
Oh, I of course, think that slavery was wrong, and I wished she had come out more forcefully. I think she made a mistake there. She also made a mistake, in my view, during the Civil War to not discuss it in her magazine and instead present Godey's Lady's book as a refuge for women to come where they didn't have to think about slavery. And I think that was wrong. So she really she was in her 60s by then, and she just retreated during that period.
You know, we mentioned Thanksgiving and sort of in the middle of the Civil War, she was able to get President Lincoln to make a declaration of a national holiday there. And today, of course, we're more than 400 years away from 1621, lots of rethinking and reframing of the traditional story of the Pilgrims and Native peoples here. Talk to us about what Thanksgiving looked like in her time and why she was pushing so hard for it to be a standardized national holiday.
At the end of the 18th and early 19th century, Thanksgivings were decided by the governors of individual states. So Hale saw Thanksgiving as a way to unify the country in keeping with the idea of cultural unity. And as the Civil War approached, she grew even more adamant about this. She thought that if Americans celebrated, gave thanks to God on the same day, that it could keep war from happening. She also saw it as a kind of patriotic day in keeping with the 4th of July, which was celebrated in the summer, and Washington Birthday, February 22nd, for those of you too young to know, remember that. So Thanksgiving being in the fall would come at a good time when Americans needed a break, but also it would fit in with the idea of celebrating America. It was another homegrown holiday.
So Melanie, just in our last 60 seconds here, just thinking about where we are today, lessons from Sarah Josepha Hale, and maybe this idea of a national holiday of a way to bring Americans together. I don't think it's fair to say we're more divided than ever, but we are pretty divided. There was an insurrection at the Capitol in January. Talk to us about what we can learn from Sarah Josepha Hale.
I think we can learn something about balance from her. She did oppose the aspects of the women's rights movement. While she was intellectually clear about what she wanted, she was never nasty And I think we could learn something from her grace and goodwill.
Melanie Kirkpatrick is the author of the book Lady Editor, Sarah Josepha Hale and the Making of the Modern American Woman, and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. She spoke with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna back in August. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Thanksgiving edition of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Thanksgiving edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour we have been listening back to some of our favorite recent conversations about rethinking some holidays that reflect our history. Indeed, we cannot consider our Commonwealth's history and place it in a truer light without also acknowledging and reckoning with our country's history with slavery and race. It's been 13 years since Massachusetts' first black governor, Deval Patrick, signed the first proclamation commemorating Juneteenth in Massachusetts. This summer, as the nation observed it as a federal holiday for the first time, the Commonwealth celebrated the day as an official state holiday, also for the first time. Juneteenth, at its most elemental level, is a celebration, marking the day in 1865 that slavery came to an end in Texas. Of course, it's so much more than that. And back in June, we dove into that powerful history with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Annette Gordon-Reed. She is a professor at Harvard and author of numerous books, including her latest, On Juneteenth. And we began with this idea beyond my very brief summary. What does Juneteenth really mark?
Juneteenth marks June 19th, 1865, the day that United States Army General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, and issued General Order Number 3, which announced the end of slavery in Texas. And it was originally called Emancipation Day, but over the years, it became Juneteenth, and that's the way it's been celebrated for a very, very long time.
So now, bring it here. Bring Juneteenth from Texas to New England. Why is something that started so locally elsewhere now so important locally here?
That's a good, very good question. As near as I have been able to determine, the holiday left Texas, came out of Texas, as Texans moved away from the state. The Texas diaspora introduced the holiday to places and around the country. And I think there has been a hunger for some day to commemorate the end of slavery. Now, this is not the total end of slavery. It was a process of emancipation. It caught on with people. It's a summer holiday. It's a family day. It's a day for barbecuing and fun. And as sort of a lead up to precursor to July 4th, it fits with this desire to recognize the end of slavery.
In your book On Juneteenth, you make this connection with sort of the evolution of the holiday and your evolution, if I may, in your understanding of the state you grew up in Texas, mm-hmm. your understanding
yes.
of its history, our collective need to understand its history. That is, as you've said, where the first Juneteenth was celebrated. So let's dig into that a little bit. And I think the first question for you is, what was Juneteenth to you growing up in Texas?
Well, growing up, it was primarily a fun family holiday that I look forward to. It was a day of drinking as much red soda water as we could contain for kids, and that's basically pop. Eating barbecue, throwing firecrackers, lighting sparklers, just a day of fun. And as I got to be older, I understood more the serious nature of the holiday in the sense that it was something that you're commemorating the end of slavery. But as a kid, it was a mini family reunion and a time for community, you know, good spirits and good cheer.
Yeah, how do we make sense of that? This idea, as I'm hearing you talk about it, of something that is fraught with the import of history, but also for a child or a family, a moment of joy and celebration. As a historian, do we have a lot of those where it's both fraught and joyous? It's a big moment, and also it's just a small, intimate celebration.
Not many. not many things. I'm trying to think about the fourth has a different valence to it. I mean, the fourth, I suppose, is the day commemorates the beginning of the United States of America and the American Declaration of Independence. Juneteenth celebrates the end of slavery in Texas, but we know that it was a very difficult time after that for the enslaved people, because they were doing this celebrating in the midst of people who had been their former enslavers, who were not so happy about all of that. So it was, I've said other places that it was a mixture of sort of hope and hostility, hope in the midst of hostility, that you don't typically think of July 4th. July 4th, we can say, well, the Declaration didn't live up to all of its promises and so forth, but the United States of America was formed. The country did become a country. With Juneteenth, slavery ended, but another series of travails began. So it's, it's a happy day. We can't minimize how those people felt when they learned that legalized slavery, in which they were, bought and sold, separated from their families, all those kinds of things, no longer existed. But we are also mindful of the fact that this was the beginning of another set of struggles that the freed people had to endure.
You said hope in the midst of hostility, and then you talked about another round of travails. And we were saying that, a lot of this book is about your childhood. It was fascinating to learn that you were a childhood trailblazer, that you integrated a white school before it was court mandated. Sorry, I have trouble saying that word. And I expected more of a story of hope in the midst of hostility in that experience. But in many ways, you were naive of the experience that was happening around you.
Well, I knew it was a momentous thing. I knew from the way people talked about it that this was a big deal. But I grew up in a town where when I went to the doctor, there were separate waiting rooms for white people and black people. When I went to the movie with my brothers, we sat in the balcony. Black people had to sit in the balcony. So I understood the racial, I sort of experienced the living the way race, was lived during that time period, even before I went to school. But I knew that there was something important about what I was doing. And I suppose I was, as a six-year-old, I wasn't aware of the worldwide implications of it, obviously, because I was of my age. But I was in a situation where I had a teacher, my first grade teacher, who was just wonderful to me. Some of the kids were nasty and some of the kids were nice. But I took all of that pretty much in stride. It was a difficult time in some ways, but I liked school. I liked learning things. I was a good student. And I don't wonder if I would have had a different time of it if I had not been a good student. In other words, if there had been other kinds of problems grafted onto the stresses of integrating a school. But for the most part, I would say I made it through without real trauma.
So Annette, now we fast forward and your town celebrates you. There is a mural of you. There is a bust of you. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. How does it feel now to look back on that childhood, to be talking about our racial history in America, reflecting on things like Juneteenth, and now be celebrated in that very community?
Well, it feels good. I wish my parents were alive to see this. This would have meant a lot to them. But I'm also mindful of the fact that we still have a lot of problems. There's still issues in Texas and in other places about voting, about what kind of history we can teach in schools. It's still part of a struggle in lots of ways. I mean, we've had advances, obviously. The fact that people would honor me in that way suggests that that things have advanced, but there's still issues. And so I'm happy about it, but I'm also mindful of the fact that Texas and other parts of the country right now are going through a lot as we try to figure out in this, in the midst of what people have called a racial reckoning, what direction the country is going to take.
Let's unpack that a little bit. One of the references you just made there in that answer was to struggles over what people can teach in schools. And I was struck in your book where you talk about the idea that people may complain about revisionist history, or have criticism might be a better word, that as we do projects like 1619, as we begin to look critically at the history we've taught ourselves and the way slavery, for example, is missing from it, Black contributions are missing from it, that somehow that's revising. You say no, that's completion in the book. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, revisionist history, people use that term in a pejorative sort of way. But what they're not realizing is that history is always being revised constantly. Every good historian is a revisionist historian in the sense that new information comes to light and you have to write things differently in light of that, of the new information gleaned. Different people ask different questions about material. Some people could look at a document, say the Texas the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, that has many provisions talking about race, in which they basically, the state has a full-throated support for the institution of slavery, which says that Black people, people of African descent, can't become citizens. They can't come to the state and reside there without permission, all those kinds of things. People could read that document. Some historians, and some historians did read it, and they may not have thought anything about those provisions. But there's no way now that people looking at that document would not take note of those provisions and not see that it helped to shape Texas and shape Texans and their experiences in the state. So we're attuned to those things now, and we pay attention to them. And so history is always being revised because, as I said, every generation has its own questions about the past, and because we find out new things and we want to incorporate those new things into the story.
So let's bring that back home here again. You know, we're in New England. We love the opportunity here to talk about Plymouth. Last year on our show, we marked the 400th anniversary. I'm chuckling because you addressed that in the book, and I heard you chuckle about that too. We marked the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's arrival last year by looking more deeply into the history of the Indigenous people here then, here now. You talk about that narrative a bit in the book, why the narrative has persisted. Why has it that America started with the arrival of Puritan pilgrims here in 1620?
Well, it's a more uplifting, I guess, in some ways, but a more uplifting story about people coming to escape religious persecution. Communities, family, religion, all those kinds of things. But it's a more uplifting story than, say, Jamestown, which is a story where people are coming essentially to make money and where they very quickly began to institute a system of plantation of slavery. And, you know, Jamestown obviously is before Plymouth. And as I talk in the book, you know, Florida and St. Augustine is before both of them. Well, before both of them, the Spanish are here and doing all kinds of things. But Plymouth gives you a, if you leave out the Native American part, which people did for the longest period of time, other than the story of Thanksgiving, it's a better story than Jamestown, where people are just there to make money and there's no higher power, no higher thing that they're trying to recur to. So that's a preferable start to the narrative.
You know, you talk about that so often in the book, this idea that what we hunger for is the mythological story, the better story that we can rally around. And as a result, in our telling of stories and our sort of worshiping is too strong a word, but we'll use it for now, our worshiping of historical figures, we embrace an incomplete picture because it's a better story and it's less complex. What do we lose when we do that, you know, there's real implication to that in the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Well, because you lose reality, you lose a sense of what's really going on in a place. It's a bit of essential information. It's like you're trying to put something together, and there are ingredients that are missing from it. And here, you don't really know why certain things are happening. You don't have a sense of the origins of things. You know, it may not be. The stories of the past may not all be pleasant, and they're not always going to be present if you're dealing with them realistically, but at least they tell you the condition of your society. They give you a sense of why we are doing these kinds of things. And you can't help to fix, it's sort of hard to fix things if you don't understand the nature of the problem. So mythology, and I do talk a little bit about this, and it's not just Americans who do this. All societies have their myths, and that sort of suggests that this may be something that we need at some level. But we also need history, and we have to be realistic about the past if we have any hope of figuring out who we are and doing better for the future.
You know, so I said at the very beginning of our conversation that the Commonwealth will celebrate Juneteenth as an official state holiday this Saturday for the first time. What is the potential of that in the moment we are in, a year after the murder of George Floyd, several years into protests again and reckoning again with our racial history? What is the potential for communities observing Juneteenth?
Well, the potential is that people will do what I was saying before. Think about how we got here. Why do we have these kinds of problems? Where did this come from? And people have to understand that Juneteenth, 1865, was not so long ago, really. I mean, I knew my great-grandmother, who lived till I was about 11. Her mother had been born in slavery and had been freed as a child by her father, who owned her and her mother. My great-grandmother knew her, my grandmother knew her, and I knew them. So I know people who knew people who had been enslaved. And so these things are not so long ago. And I think Juneteenth, celebrating Juneteenth and thinking about that will help us sort of draw the lines, not one line, but to think about how we have arrived at a point where we have racial problems, that we have a system of racial hierarchy that we've been chipping away at for most of the 20th century and part of the 21st century through law and education and all of those things. And we've made some progress, but it would make us think about, we still have a way to go here. So this holiday invites us to think about the legacies of the past, and, you know, doing that in the summer. I know there will be celebrations, but it's also a time for education, which people are trying to do as well.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a university professor at Harvard, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, her latest book, On Juneteenth. We spoke with her in June of this year. And that's our show for today. Thank you for listening and for joining us on this journey of discovery as we reconsidered America's history through the lens of holiday. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.